Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins. Despite efforts to bridge the racial gap in healthcare, big disparities remain. That's especially true in the American South, and particularly for pregnant women. In South Carolina, for instance, Black women are more than four times as likely to die from a pregnancy-related cause compared to their white counterparts. Even more, the disparities are worse when compared to other developed countries like Australia, and places where you would think that the United States might be a little more equal with. That data is from reporting by KFF Health News, where reporter Lauren Saucer has focused on this issue. She joins us today to discuss, along with two medical professionals, OBGYN Dr. Omar Young of UNC Chapel Hill and Mecklenburg County Public Health Director Dr. Raynard Washington. Let's start with you, Dr. Washington. I wanted to kind of set the stage and the landscape of what maternal health, infant mortality, and the disparities look like here in Mecklenburg County. When you presented this to county commissioners as part of the State of the County Health Report in September, this was one of two areas you identified as a critical need and where Mecklenburg County was qualified as getting worse. So what do the statistics tell us? What is the picture like out there? And what are you seeing?
Well, great. Good morning, Eli, and thank you for having me on the show this morning. Always a pleasure to be here. So in Mecklenburg County, unfortunately, we see what we see in too many communities, particularly large urban communities across the country. As it relates to, I'll start first with infant mortality, where I think we do have, we have seen some progress. I would say over the last several decades, infant mortality has consistently improved here in Mecklenburg County. And that's actually good news. I think, you know, infant mortality is a marker of how healthy any community is. And so we've seen some progress there. What's persisted as it relates to infant mortality is the disparity between non-Hispanic white babies and non-Hispanic Black babies, where we have a huge 3.5-time difference in terms of the number of non-Hispanic Black babies we're losing in the first year of life. So that, of course, is a staggering statistic that has been persistent and that we continue to work to try to close that gap. Again, we've seen progress across all racial groups, but that gap hasn't yet closed. The story is similar with maternal mortality, where we are seeing, again, a huge disparity between Black and non-Black mothers in our county, where and we have for every one non-Black mother that dies, we have five Black mothers that are dying in the first year, soon after they're either during birth or right after the period right after the birth. And so those disparities persist here in Mecklenburg County, and that's what we're seeing not just here across the state and across the country. And many of these deaths, unfortunately, Eli, are actually preventable. And so that is the work that we're doing in partnership with our healthcare systems, our community partners, to figure out ways how we address the systems that are continuing to make it more difficult for these moms to be healthy.
And Lauren, you are based in Charleston, and I know you've written about this extensively across the South. How do the Carolinas compare and fit in to the bigger picture? And how does the American South fit into the bigger picture around these issues of maternal mortality and infant mortality and health?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. Broadly, when you're looking at infant mortality and maternal mortality, South Carolina is considerably worse than North Carolina. And when you're looking across the region of the Deep South, we're worse than the rest of the country. There are pockets around the country that are troubling, but when you're really looking at these broad regions, things are bad down here. And as Dr. Washington said, when we're talking about these numbers, the numbers that are really problematic are when you're looking at Black mothers and babies. If you sort of tease out the numbers for white infants and white women, those numbers are fine, better than national averages, really, in most places. But it's this disparity, this racial disparity that's really the issue here.
And Dr. Young, you are both an academic who studies these issues and a clinician who is treating and interacting with patients. What do you see as some of the causes behind these disparities we're talking about? When you're in clinic, talking with patients, interacting with people, what do you see as really driving this?
So I think it's important for us to step back just for a second to understand exactly that the cause of everything that we see is not race, it is racism. And it is nothing is inherent in like the amount of melanin that you or I have in my skin that contributes to what other health outcomes that we'll have. And so I always tell folks that the healthcare outcomes that are experienced by Black women or Black pregnant people are due to systems that are not set up for the success and for them to have the best healthcare outcomes. And so I see folks that have had no insurance. I see folks that have had no access to a primary care doctor, and their first interaction with the healthcare system where they can have regular visits would be during pregnancy. I see folks who have access to medical care but are actively ignored by their healthcare providers. And so all of this together contributes to the continued unacceptable adverse pregnancy outcomes and adverse perinatal outcomes that we see in this nation.
And you were a co-author on an August study, I believe, that looked at the literature on interventions to address some of this perinatal mortality. And one of the conclusions I saw in that study was that there was not a lot to study, that these the literature was kind of limited and there wasn't a ton of research. Have these issues and racial disparities historically been ignored by the medical profession?
Yeah, I think I don't necessarily want to say ignored, but I would want to say it is something that just hasn't been thought of as an issue. And now, in the last, like, I would say 15 to 20 years, people have been putting forth proposals, as we had outlined in our study, of that, oh my gosh, there are issues in disparities in pregnancy care. But the question now in 2024 is, while we know that there are issues related to the provision of reproductive care, particularly for Black folks, what are we going to do about it? And so our study is an example of we are tired of having to tell the stories of patients that are suffering. And now we are going to take on the agency and fixing these issues actively. And we want others to understand exactly what this issue is, because it's just not a Black issue. It's just not a brown issue. It's a healthcare issue. And it underscores exactly how our system is set up to fail us.
And Dr. Washington, from where you sit in Mecklenburg County, what are you doing to address this issue, and what is the county doing, both, in terms of directly providing health care, but maybe also looking at some of these broader systems? What does that really mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll echo some of the remarks that have been made already. The factors that are driving the disparities that we see specifically in maternal health outcomes for Black mothers are things like structural racism, which is this whole notion that our community, our society is not set up necessarily to meet the needs of Black and brown women, specifically in the healthcare space, people not having adequate access to healthcare that they need early enough. We know for especially for Black women, prenatal care initiation does lag behind other racial groups. Then there's also this layer of the social and economic inequality and the inequities that we see in things like ability to be able to move up the economic or wealth ladder that contribute to a person's ability to be healthy. And then, as already been mentioned, the racism and implicit biases that exist within our healthcare system, all of these things together create really a recipe for disaster as it relates to the disproportionality of maternal mortality we see among Black mothers. And it's not just death, it's also morbidity, right? Just having even more complications. So the county has taken a significant systems level approach. We convened a cohort of key leaders across the maternal health, as well as prenatal care, as well as the early infant health space, some years ago, to develop what we call a prenatal to three plan that is essentially a strategic plan for our community to help ensure that we are producing, we're giving all moms an equal opportunity to have a healthy pregnancy, as well as making sure that kids have an opportunity early on in the first, those critical years of life, to be able to learn and develop on pace. And prepare them to enter the educational space. But the reality is, it's not solely the work of Mecklenburg County as an institution. This is the work of our entire system. So we've had to bring together our healthcare partners, both of our major healthcare systems, and not just them, but also our network of low-cost healthcare providers and FQHs, federally qualified health centers, who are providing this care directly to patients, to make sure they understand the importance of this issue. As Dr. Young has already said, we've got to raise awareness. Earlier this year, we held a Black Maternal Health Summit in partnership with Caring, where we were a supporter of their effort, and we're looking forward to hosting that again next spring, to really start to have this conversation where we're talking about sort of what it is that Black moms need in our community, and how can we be advocates for them, both to our healthcare systems, not just the systems themselves, but also to payers, like Medicaid and Medicare, to make sure that our families, and private insurance companies as well, to make sure they're receiving the support that they can, that they need. But I think it's also important that one of the most important things that we're doing in our work is listening to our community members, listening to Black mothers who are experiencing what they're experiencing in the healthcare system, and developing systems to be able to track what those experiences are, so that we can have data to help us understand and drive our decision making, as well as we prioritize what we're trying, what strategies we need to take initially. So we've launched a pregnancy risk assessment monitoring system here in Mecklenburg to be able to help us understand better what pregnant moms' experience are, both in the healthcare system during pregnancy and after. And we'll continue a number of strategies over the course of the next several years to really tackle this issue, as well as infant mortality.
And Mecklenburg County, Charlotte, of course, we might not have equal access, but we do have a lot of resources. So we have a lot to build off of. There are rural communities not too far from here that have a lot less. And Lauren, you've written about this in the South, the closure of historically Black hospitals that followed integration and left a lot of rural communities in the end with fewer resources locally. How do you see that connected to this issue? And what has your reporting showed about that?
I think it's an interesting topic. The story that you're referring to, I spent some time in Mississippi earlier this year and wrote about a Black, historically Black hospital that was in a small town in the Delta called Mound Bayou. And the Taborian Hospital has a really rich and unique history, and the building is vacant right now. But I sort of used it as an opportunity to talk about how across the South, during the Jim Crow era, there were hundreds of hospitals that served Black patients, because many hospitals wouldn't admit them, and that was a direct result of racism during that time period. I live, like you said, in Charleston, and one of the major court case, essentially, people call it the Brown versus Board of Education for healthcare, was involved a hospital right here in Charleston.
And we'll come back to that in just a moment. We've got to take a quick break here. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. We're talking about maternal and infant mortality health disparities.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo in for Mike Collins. Lauren, right before the break, you were talking about a court case, and I wanted to go back to that.
It was a historic federal court case that forced hospitals across the region to finally desegregate. And this didn't happen, notably, until I think it was 1969. So we're talking, years after school integration, and basically what happened when Medicare was passed in this, in earlier in the 60s, in order to qualify for Medicare funding, hospitals were not allowed to be segregated. So because of that, Medicare effectively desegregated hospitals across the country. But some hospitals held out and refused to admit Black patients even after that. And there was a court case, like I mentioned, in Charleston that finally settled that issue once and for all. But the story that I was referencing was the fact it was about all of these historically Black hospitals that existed before Medicaid was before Medicare and Medicaid were established. And they were essentially what's the phrase I used in the story? They were casualties of progress because once hospitals integrated, the need for Black hospitals sort of died off. So you're left with communities like Mound Bayou in Mississippi that I visited earlier this year that were that once had hospitals and now don't. And there has been very limited research specifically about how the closure of these historically Black hospitals impacted health outcomes in these communities. But I think what we can say with we can say that there are pockets, as you mentioned at the top of this question, that are very underserved. Rural communities across the South, where access is much more difficult than in places like Charlotte and Charleston. And that when it's hard to get to a prenatal appointment because you live far away, or because your rural hospital closed, or because there are nearly, I think, a dozen counties in South Carolina alone where there are no OBGYNs. That's a huge barrier when you're talking about getting prenatal care. So the fact that that there are no providers or healthcare systems set up in these communities is definitely contributing to the problem.
And, I want to ask a question about the underrepresentation of Black physicians broadly and in maternal medicine as well. When you had these hospitals and this sort of parallel healthcare system in Charlotte, there was the Good Samaritan Hospital. There were many disparities in the level of care, but there was a core, a cadre of Black physicians and nurses, so they could treat their community. Now we have a situation where the statistics I saw were 6% of all physicians are Black, and that's far less than the share of the population. Dr. Young, how does representation and the lack thereof play into some of these disparities we're seeing with maternal and infant mortality?
Yeah, I think what Lauren was talking about outlines exactly why there is so much medical distrust amongst communities of color. When I have patients to this day, like in 2024, I have a Black patient come into my high-risk obstetrical office and they see me, a Black man. They're like, wait, you're the physician? You're going to take care of me? And you can see that their whole demeanor changes. They relax. They are able to understand exactly why I need to give potentially some really devastating information. And they are able to digest that. And there's that relatedness that allows them to obtain the care that they so desperately not only want, but need and deserve. And so when we have systems like our current medical schools and residencies, in which you may have some programs that there's only one, let's just say, historically marginalized person in the entire program, then that is going to place a significant burden on that person in terms of why do I have to be the representative for the entirety of everything that happens to that race? Why am I being, and some people feel that they are gaslit in trying in training and made to feel as if they're less than, they're critiqued more harshly, their evaluations are much different compared to their white colleagues. The attrition rate for Black physicians in the United States is 20% higher as compared to those white trainees. And so we need to step back and understand exactly, yet again, race is not the problem, it is racism. And I'm gonna say that till there is no longer racism in this country. We in the medical space, traditionally have not operated in a space in which we say that things are political, but the politics of the current environment behoove us to speak out on behalf of our patients and ourselves in order to actually practice the medicine that we professed that we would do when we were in medical school.
And we'll get to those politics in a minute here, but I wanted to first kind of play devil's advocate a little with this question and pose a counter question of, shouldn't physician competence matter? If people can see a doctor, what does it matter what that doctor looks like? That's what you hear from people sometimes. What do you say when people ask you something like that? Why does it matter, and why isn't just having access to any old doctor good enough?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So, if physician confidence was such an issue, then why are we not allowing students of color to come into medical schools and have equitable opportunities to access medical training, residency programs, surgical opportunities, so on and so forth? There's actually a great study back in 2018 looking at this very issue. And when you put racial discordant patient-physician pairs together, the overriding issue that contributed to increased positive healthcare outcomes was communication and relatedness between the physician-patient dyad. And so if a patient and a physician are able to come together on common ground and to understand each other, and if I'm more likely to be successful in you following the recommendations that I want you to follow for your own benefit. It's not an issue of just putting bodies into a room. And that's the argument that people use with respect to affirmative action. Affirmative action is essentially leveling the playing field so that everyone can have equity and access to what people want. And so I always am cautious of that. We need to really, really be mindful that the patient is the center of it. And if we really want patients to have the best healthcare outcomes, we really need to meet the patients where they are.
And one issue that this ties into, of course, is the training pipeline and access of students to medical school residencies and support in there. There's been, as you alluded to, a big change in what's allowed when it comes to affirmative action in admissions. There have been efforts against DEI programs. I'll throw this out to the group there. What impacts do you see this having potentially on Black physician representation in the years ahead?
Oh, it's definitely going to decrease. It's going to discourage individuals from going into this profession. We talk a lot about pipeline programs in terms of going into high schools and colleges and seeing exactly, giving them perspective on what it is to be successful as a Black physician. I would argue that we need to start this earlier. It needs to start in kindergarten. It needs to start in Head Start. we should normalize the fact that, yes, just because you happen to be Black, yes, you can be a physician. Yes, you can be successful. The role modeling, the mentorship that Black children need and desperately crave is going to be essential for the success of the next generation. So it is important that we set them up for that success.
And Dr. Washington, I think you wanted to jump in.
I want to get back on another question you asked about sort
Sure.
of the competencies
Yeah, go
of
ahead.
healthcare providers. I think it's really important to note that, beyond physicians, our healthcare system is so complicated nowadays, and it's difficult to navigate for even a simple thing like scheduling an appointment. And so one of the things that we acknowledge and recognize that beyond sort of the cultural sensitivity, appropriateness, as well as preparedness of physicians. And I think it's a both and. It's not enough to be competent. I think it's important that you also have those cultural competencies. So as Dr. Young said, you can establish a level of trust and engagement with your patients that allows them to feel comfortable sharing some of the most intimate details of their life with you, right? And so I think that's important. So I do think it's really a both and. We need competent and proficient physicians. We need those available in every community. To Lauren's point earlier, we've got to make sure that folks living in rural parts of our state and our country are able to access care. I am encouraged by some of the mobile efforts that are happening across the country to bring mobile health care to communities. I know our healthcare systems here locally are doing that and providing even prenatal care on fully equipped mobile units. But I think the entire workforce really has to be prepared to serve people, from the registrars at the front desk to the nurses who do the triage, who ask those initial questions and make some real critical decisions about whether or not a person is telling the truth, or whether or not they're healthy or not, or whether or not they actually have a problem. We've heard the stories countless again of new moms or pregnant women going to ERs and talking to a nurse and telling their story and not being believed, and being sent home by a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner or a physician even, or nurse who have not necessarily listened to their story. So I think this notion of having people prepared to serve extends not just to physicians, but the entire healthcare workforce. It also extends to even the public health workforce. Our teams have to be prepared to do that as well. As you were talking about integration and segregation, I was reminded that Mecklenburg County Public Health was not desegregated until 1969. And so up until that point, even at the health department, a public service, you had to a Black nurse had to serve a Black family and a white nurse served a white family. And so as we think about our history as a country, we do have to turn the tide on those years of that work. But I think we have to be intentional about preparing our workforce to make sure that we have a workforce that reflects the values and identity of the folks that we serve. That's important. But beyond that, because you can't just create nurses and doctors every day, we've got to make sure we're preparing them. And there are lots of really great training programs. There's lots of immersive experiences to help providers overcome some of those implicit biases that they bring to them. We all bring those things to work every day. We bring it to whatever we do. But being aware of what you're bringing and being able to sort of put those things to the side when it comes down to providing the best care for people is at the core of what we're trying to accomplish with some of our systems work.
And I just want to highlight something you just said that I didn't know. Mecklenburg County Public Health Services were segregated until 1969. That is shockingly recent, and we wonder why we still see disparities reflected just two generations later.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll also add, since we're on this topic, I think it goes well beyond sort of the workforce. I think, representation and leadership also matters. So we need policymakers who understand the experiences of the people that they represent. We need health directors. Mecklenburg County Public Health has been around for more than 100 years, and I'm proud and sad at the same time to say I'm the first person of color to lead it. But the reality is that we need folks in leadership who understand those experiences, whether they're Black or white, it doesn't matter, but has the sensitivity to the experience of people living in our communities that we're tasked with serving, and are working to make sure that we're serving every person, Black, white, brown, or otherwise, and making our services and our policies work for everybody.
And of course, as Dr. Young mentioned, politics play a role in this. The government plays a large role in this at all levels. And when it comes to maternal and reproductive health, probably the biggest change in the past few years is the Dobbs decision that reversed Roe v. Wade and allowed many states to enact more restrictions on abortion. In North Carolina, the limit was lowered to 12 weeks in most cases. Other states, many in the South, have enacted near total bans. What effect do you all see both the Dobbs decision and other policies that are maybe under discussion in Washington, like changes to the Affordable Care Act and reproductive healthcare access, having on maternal and infant health, specifically in communities of color?
I know data out of Texas that shows that the infant mortality rate has increased significantly since Texas passed their ban, which predates Dobbs by a little bit. Texas was sort of the place we were looking at because their restrictions were set in place a little bit earlier. And it does take a few years, as I'm sure Dr. Washington knows, for this data to start coming out. It lags a little bit, but we're not expecting it to get better.
Yeah, I think there are a few things, Eli. You know, one thing that's important to acknowledge is that with all of the I would say, noise about the issue, people are confused. There's a lack of clear information about what people can access, what they can't access. And even when there is not any changes, people fear that there has been a change. And so they change their behavior because they think something's different. And so I think it's really important for us to acknowledge that the ongoing rhetoric about anything really creates a level of misinformation or confusion for residents that concerns us, because we don't want people to unintentionally or inappropriately avoid care that they actually need. And so I think what we anticipate, thankfully, here in our state, we haven't seen drastic changes to policy. But we are working to make sure that we're providing that information to folks so they know what's available to them and can prepare.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo in for Mike Collins, and we'll be back in just a couple short seconds to continue our discussion about maternal infant mortality in North Carolina and the South and some of the racial disparities that persist.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo, in for Mike Collins. We're joined today by Mecklenburg County Public Health Director Dr. Raynard Washington, Dr. Omar Young from UNC Chapel Hill, and Lauren Saucer, a reporter for KFF Health News covering the American South. We're talking about ongoing disparities, racial disparities in maternal and infant health, and some of what's being done to address those. Before we turn to solutions, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the overall political climate. Dr. Young, you mentioned how as a physician, maybe there's a tradition of being non-political, but you think it's time to step up and advocate more for your patients. Let's dig into that. What does that look like? And what specifically do you mean when you're talking about that?
Yeah, I think obstetrics and gynecology is a unique specialty given what is going on currently in politics, in which we have a platform to use our voices to advocate for patients. This nation does not have a great track record in the provision of healthcare for women. Research in reproductive health is supremely underfunded. It's not surprising to understand why that happens. And so we as reproductive health physicians, workers, providers, it's important that we stand up for those that don't have the voices to do that for themselves, whether that involves platforms such as these, whether that involves education, medical education, whether that involves testifying in state houses or national venues, letter writing, what have you. But I think silence is a choice, and being silent only enables those that want to take away the rights of reproductive folks.
And Lauren.
I was going to sort of piggyback on what Dr. Young just said. And even beyond politics, this is something that I try to remind myself of often. The reason that the topics that we're talking about today matter, and I guess you could say why public health matters even more broadly than that, infant mortality, maternal mortality, these numbers reflect how we as communities and states and a country take care of the most vulnerable people among us. I mean, literally, there is no one more vulnerable than a baby. And if we aren't doing a good job keeping them alive, that is a reflection on our priorities. And I think, obviously, it's tragic when an infant dies or a woman dies. But beyond that, like, there's a bigger reason to care for everyone to care about what we're talking about today, whether or not you're a person of reproductive age or not. And so that's why I think this has been a focus of mine for so many years, because to me, it's very clear that this is something that everyone should care about.
I want to also just say the kinds of things that we could expect to have negative impacts from people not having access to certain reproductive health services. We've made great progress in teen pregnancies in this country, reducing that number significantly over the last several decades. Obviously, unintended pregnancies that potentially have, when mother has health risks or health other risk, it could create risk for the baby and mom in the long term. And those kinds of issues certainly we could start to see those kinds of complications, as Lauren said, in the data in the next several years.
And, I don't know if public health has ever been a sleepy corner of government, but it seems like in the last few years, it's obviously been one of the hottest. With the change in the administration and President-elect Trump's appointment of RFK Jr. To oversee so many health issues and agencies, his skepticism of, everything from vaccines to fluoride in the water. Do you have concerns, Dr. Washington, that, this public health skepticism will negatively impact public health departments at the local level, like the one you lead?
Well, I think the last several years we've seen very clearly the role that the variety of sources of information has played in sort of people's own decision making about their healthcare, whether it be from federal leaders, state leaders, or even local leaders. The amount of noise, I would say, or misinformation, disinformation, or information that's not based in data or science, has driven a growing resistance to what we have actually considered to be settled science in public health. We know vaccines save lives. We know for a fact that we have saved millions of lives because of vaccine and prevented a lot of morbidity in our community, but we've still seen this rising tide of folks who are hesitant or resistant. And so we are continuing to work. And so we continue to have those critical conversations that we had to have throughout the entire COVID-19 pandemic. We have those conversations today with families who are dealing with childhood preventable, with infections in childhood that are actually preventable by vaccine. And so we continue to deal with that day to day here in in our community. And it's not a single person, it's not a single institution. It's an entire ecosystem. It's social media, it is the media, it is all these places where people can get information that then we're left, non-health experts are left to decipher what's the truth and what to believe. And so it's no question that people are confused or untrusting. And so we in public health, first, we don't really want to be in the middle of any political ping pongs. That's not the place that we want to be in. And we try to avoid that because our work is grounded in data and science. And so we are working to make sure that we continue to build and rebuild that trust to the best extent possible. And we do need to be speaking in unison across our local, state, and federal partners to ensure that confidence in our community. And also, but I agree. I mean, we have to have a level of transparency about what that means, how we got to our decisions. And I think, I'm proud of the work we've been doing here locally and even in our state to make sure that we are transparent Prairie Public Health System, and that we're communicating as best possible to our residents.
Dr. Young.
I totally agree with everything that Dr. Washington said. I just think it's also really important to recognize that a lot of patients these days are getting information from non-traditional sources. So like your Instagrams, your Facebooks, your Blue Skies now. And so when they come to the office with these questions, we as providers shouldn't really be looking at them like, you know, they have two heads, but really understanding where they're coming from in terms of what information they're trying to garner and what is the exact decision they're trying to make. And we need to have a consistent message as to say, you know, I recognize that I hear that they're that the flu vaccine is quote unquote going to cause some issues, but what do the data say, and why am I even talking to you about the flu vaccination? I had a patient today who just refused to have a flu vaccine because of something that she saw on social media. And so not only are we fighting, you know, the unfortunate invasion of non-medicine people into medicine, but we're now having to battle social media and influencers who are just trying to get clicks, but actually it's going to be harmful to patients in the long run.
And in the context of disparities in racial disparities, how does this play into that? Because based on surveys I've read from Pew, there are already higher levels of distrust in the medical profession among the Black community based on the history of everything from, you know, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment to the famous case of Henrietta Lacks' cells being harvested to, you know, countless other examples. Does that make trust and building trust with patients in those communities harder than it has been?
1,000%. It is so, like, Black Americans have such a right to not trust the medical system based on the history that you just outlined. So when someone like myself comes into clinical medicine, you know, I take this as like a huge responsibility and privilege to be able to provide care to folks that look like me, that come from communities that were similar to mine. Literally sometimes just listening to patients talk and you doing nothing may be the most beneficial thing that they ever have had happen to them. And taking those little baby steps may build you to the point that, oh my God, maybe she will get vaccinated, right? Or maybe she will understand why, you know, whatever healthcare issues she has is going to affect a pregnancy. I happen to love doing preconception care. And I think preconception care is super underutilized in this country. And if we had increased access to folks getting preconception care, then it wouldn't be shocking to see mitigation of adverse pregnancy outcomes, infant mortality, and maternal mortality if these issues are addressed even before pregnancy conception occurs. Well, and so I think everything is linked.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk some more about some of those interventions and some ways that people are working to reduce these disparities and what more could be done. Dr. Washington, I know there's been a big effort to have more mobile care to get people, you know, rather than having to go to the doctor or bring the doctor to them. Tell us some more about that.
Our systems here has essentially mobilized their mobile healthcare unit for the purposes of prenatal care. So essentially identifying pregnant women in community locations and being able to get them their actual first prenatal care visit on the mobile unit, and then subsequently leadership to care that they're able to receive on a go-forward basis. We have a whole system of supports. Once people get into care, we have nurses and social workers that sit in most OB practices here in the county that are employed to the health department, but they sit there to help support women who are experiencing high-risk pregnancies. Lots of other really innovative things happening across not just Mecklenburg, but across the country. I'll cite two. One, we started a couple of years ago a partnership with Caring here locally, one of our key partners in this work to improve maternal and child health in the county, called a guided journey, where we have community health workers. So these are folks, many of whom are women who've had babies before, who've experienced the healthcare system, who actually connect with moms who are having that experience in real time and providing support to them throughout their pregnancy, helping link them to resources, help answering questions, helping them decipher the misinformation they may hear, making sure they get to their appointments. Those kinds of supports is really, really important. A similar companion program is Nurse Family Partnership, where nurses do that work as well. And so making sure that our residents who are at risk or vulnerable are supported is really, really important. And those kinds of interventions exist both here locally and across the community. And it's not just community health workers and nurses, it's also doulas. We've invested as a county in making sure we're training more doulas to be advocates and partners for pregnant people when they're giving birth in the healthcare system. And then, as I said earlier, working with our systems to make sure that they're ready to serve every resident that walks in the door, whether or not they're white, black, Hispanic, whether or not they speak English or Spanish or Russian. That the system is prepared to receive them and make them feel safe, which is what people want to feel. And so all those things are happening here locally, and we'll continue as great examples for how we close these gaps.
And
I think that
oh, go ahead.
the fact that the state's extended postpartum coverage for, women who qualify for Medicaid during pregnancy, could be really helpful, and just keeping them connected to the healthcare system, through, the first year of their child's birth. But, as Dr. Young mentioned, that doesn't give them coverage before they conceive. So, it's not going to be, it's not perfect. There's an interesting program out of Flint that I've written a little bit about it, Flint, Michigan, which has a very high numbers when we're talking about infant mortality and maternal mortality. And it started earlier this year, and they're giving direct cash payments to every woman, regardless of income, regardless of race. And I think those payments start during the pregnancy and end maybe through the child's first birthday. It's a significant amount of money. I think the last time I checked, it was like $7,500 in over the course of that time period. And the thought is that, helping people, raising people out of poverty, could help improve some of these numbers. I think that, is just one example of something that might work, but there are a lot of programs out there that are trying to address these issues. Some of them are going to work and some of them are not. The other thing is these things are expensive, and how do you roll this out not just in one community, but across, broad swaths of the country that need help. So yeah, it's definitely, these are definitely, historically intractable problems to
I
solve.
could just put quickly,
Sure.
Lauren, on the Medicaid expansion piece. I am so grateful to our state leadership for getting us across the line here in North Carolina. It is, I said earlier this year, probably one of the most consequential things we can do to make sure we improve access to care. And while that 12-month extension for people postpartum does not cover their total care, there are a lot more people who are going to get regular access to health care because of Medicaid expansion, including pregnant women. Birthing age women. And so the fact that they'll be able, and many of the folks who are in that expansion group are folks who work every single day and just aren't able to get coverage to their employer, those folks will have access to care. And one of the things we have to do, in addition to getting folks enrolled in that care, is making sure they know how to use it. How do they access primary care? How do they get access to preconception healthcare services and know they even need them? And so that still becomes a work ahead of us as we think about in the post-expansion space. How do you make sure everybody's registered and enrolled that can be, and how do they know how to use those services they now have access to?
And
Important to point out, though, that most of the South has not expanded Medicaid. I mean, North Carolina has, obviously, but where these problems are really, really pronounced, they haven't taken that step. Lawmakers haven't taken that step.
Unfortunately.
And of course, there might be changes to the federal subsidies and resources that are available to fund that going forward. So that's something we'll keep an eye on and maybe do another show on in the future. Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE. We've been joined by Lauren Saucer of KFF Health News, Dr. Raynard Washington, Mecklenburg County's Public Health Director, and Dr. Omar Young, who's an associate professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you all for the hour. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.